ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
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 Canto 3, Chapter 32, Text Number 28. Title of the chapter is Entanglement in Fruitive Activities. Lord Kapila Deva is speaking. Devahuti is listening. And the previous chapter is discussing the movements of the living entity, starting from conception and within the womb of the mother and that whole experience and birth and the difficulties of being an embodied soul in different stages. This chapter then, when the body reaches an adult stage, come over this way. When the body reaches an adult stage, fruitive activities and the bondage of fruitive activities, the chapter begins with a comparison between grihastha and grihamedi life. And to help, it's not just with a hammer bashing on grihamedi life. There is a very clear description of what grihastha life, what proper family life is. So it's an important chapter for grihasthas. But a large part of it is the section that we're reading now. The stages of enlightenment of one who's a proper grihastha, and the stages of detachment from the bondage to fruitive activities. So, just go back a bit, starting with Text 23. Engagement in Krishna consciousness and application of devotional service unto Krishna make it possible to advance in knowledge and detachment, as well as in self-realization, in contrast to the Grihamedi position. And then, so the intelligence is being discussed here. Then, exalted devotee's mind becomes equipoised, and sensory activities. That's not the case in material fruitive activities. And he is transcendental to that which is agreeable and not agreeable. Like all those verses in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where one remains indifferent between this feature of duality, that feature of duality. Pebbles, stones, and gold sees them the same. It's, the mind becomes so fixed when consciousness is upon the Supreme in devotion and not otherwise. Then 25, because of his transcendental intelligence, the pure devotee is equipoised in his vision and sees himself to be uncontaminated by matter. He does not see anything as superior and inferior. He feels himself elevated to the transcendental platform of being equal in qualities with the Supreme Person. So it's characteristics of transcendence. Obviously, Kapila Dev is promoting that, and he's demoting not being fixed in that way. It leads to the default position is a bitter struggle. Although one is hoping for happiness, it's a bitter struggle that happiness never happens, and it's a suffering condition for the soul. Text 26, the Supreme Personality of Godhead alone is complete transcendental knowledge. But according to the different processes of understanding, he appears differently, either as impersonal Brahman, as Paramatma, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or as the Purusha Avatar. Long purport. So that the state of realization is different. Even transcendental realization is different. Although the personality of Godhead is complete, realization of him may be less than complete. The next verse, the one before this one, this morning's, is detachment. The greatest common understanding for all yogis is complete detachment from matter, which can be achieved by different kinds of yoga. Like Krishna says in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, of all forms of elevation, yoga is best. So by all means, Arjuna, be a yogi. And of all forms of yoga, devotional service, bhakti yoga is the best. So, going back down, all forms of yoga have detachment as a common, greatest common understanding. Detachment from what? Detachment from matter, detachment from the mood of trying to be the enjoyer of matter, fruit of activities, trying to be the enjoyer of matter. And then backwards, those that have accomplish that to some degree, they have different realizations of the Absolute Truth. Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan, and he's adding a fourth one, the Purusha Avatars. Then this morning's verse, those who are averse to the transcendence with a capital T, realize the Supreme Absolute Truth differently through speculative sense perception, and therefore, because of mistaken speculation, everything appears to them to be relative. We make this distinction sometimes. It's not so common, and it's rare to have an actual difference between a Brahmavadi and a Mayavadi. Brahmavadi is one who realizes Brahman, and a Mayavadi is one who doesn't realize anything. They have a philosophy of something. Everything is Brahman. As Prabhupada is quoting in the word, Brahman Satya Jagan Mithya. Brahman is real and everything else doesn't exist, because all there is Brahman. And it's a philosophical position that's not supported by scripture. It's not supported by how they lead their life. It's not supported by common sense. And Prabhupada will cover it in the purport. Common sense is whatever comes from Brahman, it has a relationship with Brahman. So it's, how can you get something that's false that comes from something that's real? In the purport, he gives the example of an oyster, the inside of which may look like gold. So because the inside of the oyster is not gold, doesn't mean the oyster is false or gold is false. It just means the oyster is not gold, and it does have some other reality. Simple example. So, similarly, things that come from Brahman, which is truth, must also be truth, not false. That's just common sense. And then there's scripture that says, these are energies of Bhumi Rapo Lovayu Kamano Bhudir Evacha. Krishna doesn't say this is false, he says these are my energies. So since they're his energies coming from the truth, then they're also true. But the verse is saying, we'll read the purport, the verse is saying that because of their speculative tendency, so this is, you know, yet another category, they try to be detached by a philosophical wave of the hand that says it's all false. They don't live their life that way, it's all false. They don't live their life that it's all one. But they wave their hand and say it's false. And then involve themselves in matter. Like the, you know, the renunciate that goes to the mountains and realizes it's all one and comes down and engages in philanthropic work or political activity to uplift humanity and is praised by people. Oh, he's a great sadhu. If it's false, then why do you have anything to do with it? It's false. Why uplift humanity with philanthropic work and altruism in hospitals and education centers and, you know, influence the political affairs of the country so people are bettered? It's all false. Stick to your philosophy. But they don't. It's not practical. We don't live our life as it's all one. Although they say it's all one. So this is yet another position. Some attempt at detachment, some attempt at realization of the absolute, but a speculative approach that results in everything is relative. The absolute truth is everything is relative. And nothing is absolute. That's the absolute truth. Wait a minute. Here's Prabhupada's purport. The supreme absolute truth, the personality of Godhead, is one. And he is spread everywhere by his impersonal feature. This is clearly expressed in Bhagavad Gita. Lord Krishna says, everything that is experienced is but an expansion of my energy. Now, where's that from? Oh, Bhagavad Gita scholars. Ninth chapter, not tenth chapter. Oh, yes, that would work. But specifically, in the ninth chapter, those beginning verses 5 through 7. So what Prabhupada has just said in two successive sentences is the Supreme Lord is everywhere by his impersonal feature, and then everything that is experienced is but an expansion of my energy. So Krishna is all pervasive by his impersonal feature, and Krishna is all pervasive by his energies. Those are not identical. His energies is not his impersonal, is not the Brahman effulgence. The Brahman effulgence is not his impersonal, it's his material energies. And yet, the material energies are transformations of pradhan that are resting upon him and Brahman is resting upon him. So in that sense, back to the first sentence, this personality of Godhead is one. He's one with his Brahman, he's one with his energies, and he's all-pervading everything by his Brahman and by his energies, and yet he is separate. That's what those verses say. Everything is sustained by him, but that does not mean that he is in everything. Behold my mystic opulence, Yoga Maishwarya. So, everything is resting in him, but I am not in them. And then again, I am within everything. Mm-hmm. Behold my mystic opulence. So, he's all pervasive by his Paramatma feature. Within every atom is Paramatma. And within all the material energy is resting in his Brahman effulgence. And his material energy is spread everywhere in material creation. And yet, so Krishna, as the personality of Godhead, remains aloof. Although the oneness and difference simultaneously. Everything is sustained by him, but that does not mean that he is in everything. You follow? I think so. It's just in four sentences restating those four verses from the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Very simple form. So now how do the speculators handle all of that? Sense perceptions, because that's mentioned, through speculative sense perception. Those who are averse to the transcendence, with a capital T, realize the Supreme Absolute Truth differently through speculative sense perception. Realizations are different because of reliance upon one sense or another sense or another sense, or the mind that processes that sense perception. So, Prabhupada writes, sense perception, such as oral perception of the sound of a drum, visual perception of a beautiful woman, or perception of the delicious taste of a milk preparation by the tongue, all come through different senses and are therefore differently understood. Therefore, sensory knowledge is divided in different categories, although everything is one as a manifestation of the energy of the Supreme Lord. So this is difficult to understand by speculative method what Prabhupada is writing, or what Krishna says in the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Because the Achintya Veda Veda Tattva philosophy has this very nice Achintya component. It's inconceivable. So we can think like this, or we can think like that. We can't simultaneously think like this and that. Because the mind can't hold two opposites at the same time. The instrument is a binary processor, and it can't hold both things at the same time. And therefore it's achintya. So one can speak about the oneness, and one can speak about the difference, and then say simultaneously one and different. And we're, going back and forth like that. Okay, I got it, but how can it be both? There's oneness. But the source, the personality of Godhead is the source, is differently situated. Although nothing exists except that which is one with him. He's differently situated as the source. The source and that which comes from the source have a feature of oneness, and they have a feature of difference. They don't. Then he gives the example of the energies of fire are heat and illumination. And by these two energies, fire can display itself in many varieties or in diversified sense perception. Wherever there's heat, there's a place in our Chicago temple. The wiring is really ancient, as ancient as the building is. And it wasn't created to handle the amount of electricity, electrical wiring that's in within the walls. And so within the wall that where I stay, there's an outlet, and in the winter when Jitendra doesn't turn the heat on, it's nice to have a heater. But when you can feel on the wall, it's getting hot. And, you know, fortunately, we have little electric devices that if it gets too hot, the switch kicks, and, you know, the circuit breaker kicks on this little, you know, the power strip, and the heater goes off. But if you kept it on, it'd get hot, 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 and you'd get a fire in the wall. But it doesn't start with a fire in the wall, it starts with heat. But where there's heat, you know there's fire. So fire is variously manifested, light is also variously manifested. And for that matter, the same electricity, Prabhupada gives this example, it can be used to make things cool. If you're an electrician, if you know the science of it, the art of it, technology of it, electricity can be made to make things cool, electricity can be made to make things hot. But electricity is but the fire of the sun transformed. That's the earth, water, fire, air, ether. That's what electricity is. It's fire. So fire that's in the form of electricity that can make things hot and cold, just without going too far afield. It's one of the five elements. And wherever there's light and wherever there's heat, there's fire, just like on the altar. There's deities and there's light shining on the deities. Where's that light shining on the deities coming from? It's coming from electricity in this little bulb. And where did the electricity come from? It's trace it back and back and back, and it comes from the sun. Somehow, by storing the light of the sun, there's fuel, and the fuel is used to generate electricity. Electricity is making the bulb work. So it's just the light of the sun being manifest over there in the light bulb. And it's also there's heat. It's heat and light. So there's fire. It's controlled fire, but it's fire. Otherwise it wouldn't be heat or light. So we can say the heat and the light are inseparable from fire. But we don't say, oh, there's a fire on the altar. It's a light bulb. But it's controlled fire on the altar. So as the energies of heat and light are inseparable from fire, the energies of the Supreme Lord are inseparable from Him. And those energies of the Supreme Lord are resting in Brahman, and Brahman is resting in Him. But He has so everything is in Him, but He has a separate existence. The impersonalists aren't going to get it, because they're using the speculative method, and the speculative method relies upon the binary processor of the mind, and it can't hold both of them. So they won't get it. However acute or clever or however gymnastic their mind may become, how flexible their mind can go, it's still not going to get there. Continuing, Mayavadi philosophers declare this diversity to be false. They can't figure it out, and so just give it a bad name. It doesn't exist. What is it? Don't worry about it. It doesn't exist. But Vaishnava philosophers do not accept the different manifestations are false. They accept them as non-permanent and non-different from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because they are a display of His diverse energies. Paragraph. The philosophy that the Absolute is true and this creation is false, Brahman Satya Jagan Mithya, is not accepted by the Vaishnava philosophers. And he gives the oyster example. Although all that glitters is not gold, this does not mean that a glittering object is false. The oyster example. Similarly, by seeing the form of Lord Krishna, one cannot understand what he actually is. But this does not mean that he is false. But they say he's false. Huh? He's false, then why do you read Bhagavad Gita? Well, the Brahman has become covered. And that's what Krishna is. He's just like an elevated, very rarefied covering. So we like Bhagavad Gita. The logic would be, if Krishna is Brahman covered, which he says in Bhagavad Gita that those who think like that, they're fools. But if you just like don't read that verse and say that Krishna is Brahman covered, then why even bother taking his Bhagavad Gita as authority? Why read Bhagavad Gita or interpret Bhagavad Gita or say that this means that? You just say it yourself. You're also Brahman covered. So why need, you don't need Bhagavad Gita, just speculate. The authority of Bhagavad Gita says that he can't be understood by speculation. Show me where it says in Bhagavad Gita that by speculation one can understand the Absolute Truth. By devotional service one can understand Krishna, but not by speculation can one understand Krishna. One's going to come with a wrong understanding by the very process that's used. The form of Krishna has to be understood as it is described in the books of knowledge, such as Brahma Samhita, Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchit Ananda Vigraha. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, has an eternal, blissful spiritual body. By our imperfect sensory perception, we can't understand the form of the Lord. We have to acquire knowledge about Him. Therefore it is said in this verse, Jnanam Ekam. That's how the verse starts. Jnanam Ekam. Jnanam means knowledge and Ekam means one. So although the Absolute Truth is one, they speak of it as the Absolute Truth as relative. And then they just get out an iron and an ironing board and flatten everything. It's all false. There's different ways of, there's a Vaishnava way, as this verse is saying, of seeing that everything is related to Krishna, that sense of oneness is how a Vaishnava sees. Everything that exists is related to the source of its emanation, that sense of oneness. And the impersonalist has another idea of oneness, and the oneness is nothing exists except Brahman. So all there is homogenized oneness. There's no distinctions. And to reach that, they're using sensory perception that sees things differently. It's really contradictory. Wait a minute. There's a verse coming up, I believe it's coming up, where, maybe it's even in this chapter. Text 33. We're at text 28, so here's coming up. A single object is appreciated differently by different senses due to its having different qualities. Similarly, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is one, but according to different scriptural injunctions, he appears to be different. Philosophy is hard to have a nice morning class. Wow, it's heavy. It's too heavy. But it's Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami writes in Chaitanya Charitamrita that such discussions should not be avoided because such discussions make the intelligence strong. So the intelligence function is one of discernment, discriminating this from that. So on the topic of oneness, there's a Vaishnava conception, there's an impersonal conception. Here's what this is and here's what that is, the Vaishnava conception and the impersonal conception. And the impersonal conception doesn't hold water. To say everything is one, the impersonalist, the Mayavadi specifically, says Brahman, Satya, Jagat, Mithya. The diversities are false. They just don't exist. This chair that I'm sitting in doesn't exist. The body that's sitting in the chair, it doesn't exist. There's only one thing that exists. That's Brahman. Then why sit in the chair? Then why do anything? Because it doesn't exist. Why don't you be consistent with your philosophy? So that kind of oneness the Vaishnav rejects. But there's another kind of oneness that the Vaishnav accepts. That's presented in those first several sentences of the purport. The oneness of all things from their source of emanation, once again, the Paramatma feature, Brahman feature, the energies of the Lord, they're all pervasive and they're connected with the source of emanation. That kind of oneness exists. And still the absolute truth, personality, Godhead exists unto himself. But now we have this dimension of the senses, which Prabhupada has explained. The ear hears the sound of the drum, the eye sees some form that appears attractive. Looking out my window, I saw this nice tree, it has these spring little things, white flowery things drooping down. Right over here, that guy right over there. And, you know, it's very nice. Seeing is very pleasing. And then spring's over and it just becomes green leaves. And then fall comes and they all turn color and they fall to the ground. And it's just a barren tree. So things of this world may appear to be attractive, and then something changes, and then it's different. The something in anyway, without so many examples. A little bird landed on the windowsill, and he was looking at me, and I was looking at him. He was showing me his colorful feathers. Look at these. These are bright orange. And doing a little profile. See the yellow ones over there? And then he flew away. Or she. So there's variegatedness from the senses, and so this approach that's being presented, Prabhupada doesn't so much speak about it in the purport. While there's varieties, I'll read the sentence again. Sense perceptions, such as sound of a drum, visual perception of a beautiful woman, perception of delicious taste of the milk by the tongue, all come through different senses and therefore are differently understood. So his point is the objects are different and the senses perceiving the objects are different, but underlying all that there's this oneness. And the oneness, the basis of the oneness is the personality of Godhead. So it's leading into this discussion where the absolute truth is also realized in different ways according to the approach that one takes of the absolute truth. So some persons favor Brahman, some persons favor Paramatma, some persons favor the personality of Godhead, some persons favor the Purusha avatars. Vishnu is supreme. Kapiladeva wants us to understand the foundation of all of them is the same. And that's, what is that foundation? That's what elucidation is, what's the absolute truth? What is that from which all things come? So there may be different realizations of features of the absolute truth. The Bhagavatam wants us to understand that the personality of Godhead, the absolute truth has different features, and the personality of Godhead is the basis of each of them. Because there is an ultimate source, and that's ultimate source is Krishna. That's the teaching of the Bhagavatam. That's what's being presented here. Material sense speculation leads to the conclusion that the Supreme is formless. Remember what the... I'll recite the verse again. That's what I just read is from the purport. Here's the verse. Those who are averse to the transcendence, with a capital T, realize the Supreme Absolute Truth differently through speculative sense perception. Through speculative sense perception, now here's the verse, sentence in the purport. Where did it go? Material sense speculation leads to the conclusion that the Supreme is formless. But here's the connection. Using these examples, seeing something, tasting something attractive, hearing something attractive. I have, through my senses, different kinds of perception of sound, taste, and form. So there's diversity. If by speculative sense perception, what conclusion am I going to reach if I'm inquiring about the absolute truth? by speculative processes, using my sense perception as a tool for that. This and this and this are different, and this isn't the source, that's not the source, that's not the source. What's the absolute truth? The source is impersonal. It must be not this, not this, not this. Conclusion is, the absolute truth is impersonal, because I'm using my speculative sense perception and the binary processor, the mind, to analyze it or filter it. It is because such mental speculation is because of such mental speculation that the conditioned soul remains in ignorance under the spell of the illusory energy. The Supreme Person has to be understood by transcendental sound vibration, vibrated by him in Bhagavad Gita, wherein he says that there is nothing superior to himself. The impersonal Brahman effulgence is resting on his personality. The purified absolute vision of Bhagavad Gita is compared to the river Ganges. Ganges water is so pure that it can purify even asses and cows. Listen to this sentence. But anyone who, disregarding the pure Ganges, wishes to be purified instead by the filthy water flowing in a drain, cannot be successful. Whoa. Waste water is the same as Ganges because everything is one. Similarly, one cannot, one can successfully attain pure knowledge of the Absolute only by hearing from the pure Absolute himself, not by speculative process. The problem is, we're prone to speculative process. We're prone to, we hear something and then we speculate on that which we hear. We read something, we speculate on that. So we're so habituated. If we don't do that, what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to understand? Just simply by hearing. And the last part of the purport goes back to the initial statement in the verse, those who are averse to the transcendence. That's really where the problem is. If we have an aversion to Krishna, that's, we're in the material world because we have an aversion to Krishna. Say it the other way. We wouldn't be in the material world if we didn't have aversion to Krishna. If we can fix that one problem, yay, we can turn to the spiritual world. But as long as we're averse to transcendence, trying to, by speculation, reach truth, it's not going to happen, because whatever is the truth, we're going to reject because we're averse to transcendence. Whatever we come up with is going to be relative, not absolute. And just call it the absolute. Brahman Satya, Jagat Nitya. There's the truth. But it's not truth. It's something that was created from our mind that's averse to transcendence. It's a loop. You just keep going in the loop. Here's one of the loops Prabhupada has very clearly expressed. If you meet a Mayavadi, says it's all one, and this material world is false and all there is Brahman. So you can ask them, what's this? Well, this is false. Okay. Well, if if I'm Brahman, but I am not realizing that I'm Brahman because I'm covered by Maya, and Maya is false, then it looks like Maya is stronger than Brahman, because Maya has covered Brahman. There's two questions, that's one. So how is it that Maya is not stronger than Brahman, and therefore Maya is truth, not Brahman? And the answer is, well, actually, Maya is false. There's no Maya, because it's false. Well, that's interesting. Then how did it happen that Maya covered Brahman, if it's false? They don't have an answer. It's just a loop. Well, that's why you don't realize that you're Brahman, because Maya has covered you. But, you know, just repeat after me, Maya is false, and then you're liberated. Because Brahman is truth, and you're Brahman, aham brahmasmi. So one is, of the two, one is, which is reality, is or which is supreme, is Maya supreme or is Brahman supreme? If Maya covers Brahman, then looks like Maya is supreme, because Maya covers Brahman. It's greater. Then the other is, well, it's not real, just false. Then the next is, how did the false come to cover that which is real? No answer. It's just word jugglery. There's no scriptural basis, ultimately, and no, not even common sense. But they're very expert in word jugglery, and so somebody that's not expert in word juggling, dealing with a word juggler, looks like they get defeated by the word juggler. Let's just stick to some basic points, and it becomes... you don't have to prove anything. So here's the last part. In this verse, it is clearly said that those who are averse to the Supreme Personality of Godhead speculate with their imperfect senses about the nature of the Absolute. And we went through that. The result of that speculation is, by speculation, the sound of the drum and the form of the beautiful woman and the taste of the food, they're false. Because they're impermanent, they're not enduring, and only that which is enduring is true, and therefore they're false. And the truth is Brahman, and aham brahmasmi, and so I'm truth. So, and this Brahman doesn't have qualities or variegatedness as my sense perception does, because it's not this, not this, not this, so Brahman must be impersonal. That's how they get to that place. So Prabhupada writes, the formless Brahman conception, however, can be received only by oral reception and not by personal experience. It's not by sense perception and processing the sense perception with the mind can one factually get an understanding of what Brahman is. Rather, factual understanding of what Brahman is comes by sound vibration from a proper source, not by that other method. Knowledge is therefore acquired by oral reception. It is confirmed in Vedanta Sutra, Shastra Yonitvat. One has to acquire pure knowledge from the authoritative scriptures. So-called speculative arguments about the absolute truth are therefore useless. Okay, here's the problem. Once again. Okay, Shastra is the source. And in the impersonalists, they go to the Shastra, and then they speculate. this means that. Because the speculative tendency is the instrument that they're using. So what's the alternative? Once again, the alternative is just hearing. Like Prabhupada has stated, Bhagavad Gita as it is. You don't have to speculate, you just receive it as it is. Krishna says, and that's the answer, by that descending process. The actual identity of the living entity is his consciousness, which is always present while the living entity is awake, dreaming, or in deep sleep. So there are different states of consciousness, but the underlying thing is consciousness. Whether it's this, that, or the other state, consciousness is present. But when consciousness is purified, in Krishna consciousness, one becomes free from the entanglement of repeated birth and death and the misconceptions that go along with it. That's what Kapila Deva is doing with Devahuti. She's very elevated. In fact, she's Kapila Deva's mother. She's a pure devotee. But by sound vibration coming from the Supreme Lord to her, or as we're hearing the conversation, third party, he's speaking to her, we're hearing it. The opportunity is there also for us, by hearing, to come to the right conclusion. Fortunately, we're being guided by one who has come to the right conclusion, one who has heard in disciplic succession, and is repeating the message in disciplic succession. By that method, we can come to the right conclusion. By hearing. So who you hear from is critical. Reading many books is ill-advised. Last paragraph. When uncontaminated pure knowledge is uncovered from the modes of material nature, the actual identity of the living entity is discovered. : He is eternally a servitor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The process of uncovering is like this. : The rays of sunshine are luminous, and the sun itself is also luminous. In the presence of the sun, the rays illuminate just like the sun. But when the sunshine is covered by the spell of a cloud, or by Maya, then darkness, the imperfection of perception, begins. Therefore, to get out of the entanglement of the spell of nescience, one has to awaken his spiritual consciousness or Krishna consciousness in terms of the authorized scripture. End of purport. Just one little appreciation. What the Bhagavatam is doing in so many verses, over so many pages and so many messages, is bringing us to the conclusion that the Absolute Truth is a person, and that person has unlimited expansions, and the unlimited expansions may be the object of one's realization. The Absolute Truth is this, or the Absolute Truth is that, or that. Because they have a connection with the Absolute, with the Source. But the Bhagavatam is helping us to understand the big picture, and that is this part of that part of the other part needs to be understood in terms of the Supreme Person. And the Supreme Person will be understood through the medium of devotional service, which begins with hearing. The process is being revealed. The result of the process, the goal, is being revealed. Even we're not qualified. Like the example of asses and cows getting purified by entering the Ganges. So our cow-like, ass-like capacity is being elevated by the message of the Bhagavatam. Just adhere regularly to the hearing process. And consciousness will gradually become elevated, illumined, and the position of Krishna becomes revealed to us by that hearing process. And the speculative process won't take you there. That's what's being said here. And then the analysis of why not is presented in the purport. Okay, so any discussion? Yes?
Maharaj, I was wondering, does the method or process of realizing the absolute truth differ depending on one's quality of work? Depending on one's tendency for work, does that influence the means by which one can most...
Sure. Or conditioned souls. Guna and karma are influencing the embodiment, and conditioned souls are impelled by their embodiment. And so tendency, certainly by our past involvement with the modes of nature and the quality of work. Sure. Another thing that's certainly a factor is presented right in the verse itself. You know, there's aversion. To the degree to which we're averse, and the ways in which we manifest that aversion is going to influence how we approach trying to acquire knowledge. And then how we live our life based upon the knowledge that we've acquired. To say it the other way around, the degree to which we're free from aversion, then we're more the freedom of approaching the absolute truth simply by devotion that's unmixed becomes possible. So we work with the conditioning that we have, because that's where we are. And if we, by proper guidance and proper application, under proper guidance, that aversion tendency will reduce, or the original consciousness of the soul will awaken. That's what's the last sentence of the whole purport. Then it's no longer tendency driven. It's just pure devotional service. Becoming, in its very direct and simple way, attracted to Krishna. Hearing about Him, remembering Him, describing Him, worshipping Him, offering prayers to Him. Not tendency driven, but devotion driven. The influence of that past conditioning is slackened through purification. You have something?
The Mayavadi philosophers claim they follow Shankaracharya.
Mm-hmm.
But Prabhupada quoted Shankaracharya's verses saying that he said that that there is a personal form to God.
Mm.
Shankara had
mentioned that. A few places.
So how come has his philosophy deteriorated?
No.
With the element of time? Or?
No. It's those references that Prabhupada makes, they're genuine references, but the preponderance of teaching is impersonal. Those references are exceptional. Narayana Paro Vyaktat. Narayana is para, is transcendental to this manifest creation, Narayana Puro Vyakta, or Vajagovinda, Vajagovinda, Vajagovinda Mudhamate. Then there's another one. But those are exceptional, and the preponderance of his teaching is impersonal. So it's not over time. Everything over time gets adulterated and deteriorated and changed and mutated beyond recognition, commonly. But those references that he make, that Prabhupada makes, even Shankaracharya confirmed. It's the exceptional confirmation part of his teachings. Something else? Yes, Nilesh.
I met one of the Sri Vaishnava friends and...
One of the which?
Sri Vaishnava friends.
Sri Vaishnava? Okay.
And the words that they quote from Upanishad, not this, to prove that only Brahman is the truth. Meaning, Shankarites quote that verse from...
Yeah.
So he quoted the same verse and he said that they cherry pick the half part of that verse, because right after that it says name of the Brahman is the truth of the Brahman. So their argument that Brahman has no name and form is defeated right after that statement. But they cherry pick certain statements.
Well, I'm sure, guaranteed sure, that Shankara has some way of describing what that is differently than what the Sri Vaishnavas did. Guaranteed. So, you know, the name of Brahman is Om, for example. Omkar. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Panavak Sarvavedeshu.
Then he also showed, like there is one Maharayana Upanishad that comes from Yajurved. It specifically describes the name of Brahman as Narayana and Krishna.
Well, then they will say that's a modern, you know, rendering, and it's not, we don't accept it. Somebody created it, you know.
But it comes right from the Shruti, like.
Okay. But I'm just repeating. They have their way of saying. You know, when there's a predisposition, you can take anything and put it under the rug. And just show what you want to show. And, you know, they'll say the same to us. You know, you're predisposed, so you see this and you don't see what we see. And it just goes on.
In the practical application, after you know reading this verse and this kind of theme, is to stop speculating and then start hearing attentively the scriptures. Is that the practical application?
Yes, but there's also a there's some added feature, and that is to understand how it is that those that speculate end up where they end up. Now, why not? Not just, you know, there's the why, and why not? There's the why dimension, besides do this and don't do that.
Another question I had is, for pure devotees who read Srimad Bhagavatam, they get the same pleasure, they get more pleasure. What kind of information that this particular theme gives for a pure devotee? Because they know there is no speculation for them. So what do they take by reading this? What is the pleasure that they derive? Or they appreciate the glory of Krishna, like how inconceivable he is?
Well, there's a number of things, not just one thing. And one of those number of things is just see how the deluding potency of our Supreme Lord is captivated a whole group of people that are searching for truth, and they end up with delusion because they don't really want him, they want something other than him and call it truth. Just see how his energy is working. How miraculous. Or as I'm moving along the path towards Krishna, let me beware. Krishna is very kind. Kapila Dev is being very kind. He's giving, you know, he's got a great GPS system. Watch out for the curve, and watch out for the potholes, and watch out for the ditch. My Lord is very kind, keeping us on the middle of the road, the straight narrow path to reach him. We all have, how kind is my Lord? We have such tendencies for trying to understand things by mental speculation, and he's kindly helping us to refrain from that by instructing Mother Devahuti, so we can hear that. Impetus for appreciation, gratitude, and surrender. And without a mix. Unmixed devotional service. Something else?
No, I just want to appreciate the purport of Srila Prabhupada. Just by reading the translation, I would not have understood anything. Thank you for your great explanation.
Thinking about aversion to Krishna, I was remembering that for myself, especially when I'm feeling say tired or you know, especially involved in my work or something, I'm not remembering about Krishna. So my question is, how do I go past such points, basically? So I'm understanding, first of all, that so when I'm not remembering Krishna, that, you know, I'm not actually serving him. So is that correct? And then if that's correct, then how do I go past?
I'm half hearing the second part of your question, because the premise of your question, there must be some way of how the aversion to Krishna connects with feeling tired at work. Could you explain that?
So when I'm feeling tired, I'm not thinking about Krishna.
Well, is that due to aversion, or is it due to being tired?
That's probably the first part of the question. Like, you know, I'm understanding that as being averse to Krishna, and
well, in a ultimate sense, we wouldn't even have a material body that gets tired if we didn't have aversion to Krishna. But once we have a material body that's the fruit of being averse to Krishna, then we deal with those circumstances. Okay, leave out the aversion to Krishna part and just, you know, what do you do when thought of Krishna fades because you're very involved in your work, or you're feeling very tired. That's you need to take a little nap. Prabhupada speaks about that. You know, it doesn't. He on the one hand encourages minimizing sleep because sleep is like death. On the other hand, he encourages that if there's one is not sufficiently rested, then one cannot be alert, including being mindful of Krishna. So in such cases, he takes the two words, a short nap, and calls it a snap. And you know, the modern language is a power nap. I've found out from people that power naps usually end up into a long snooze. But sometimes the answer is a short nap, and sometimes the cause is literally aversion to Krishna. Or, you know, this is interfering with my sense gratification, because if there was something sense gratification, I'd be wide alert, I wouldn't be fatigued. So this is boring sense gratification. I want some lively sense gratification. So it's not seeing the activity that we're doing in relation to, let's just say, chanting. If you're behind the chanting is an eagerness to be with Krishna and be attentive to Krishna, sleepiness is far away. And if that eagerness to be attentive slackens and just there's this drone of a sound vibration, then we can become tired. So revive, hit the reset button, and why am I doing this? What's the purpose behind my doing this, and what is this? This is Krishna. And I'm not at all thinking this is Krishna. This is just a duty that I have to do, and my mind is wandering and I'm sleeping. So there's two things. It may be the factual, your body needs a short rest. It may be that you're just not thinking properly about the activity. So step back from the activity and ask, you know, why am I doing this? Get the, you know, the Krishna focus centered again, even if it's something at work. Why am I doing this? And like the discussion yesterday, because I want money. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. But that's the fruitive side. Is there a devotional side? And then you look at the devotional side. I want to live a responsible grihastha life. And responsible grihastha life means realization of my relationship with Krishna and engaging in my duties in family life towards that end. So let me look at what I'm doing here in the workplace through that lens. How does that have to do with, so then you just do the reset. You don't bring Krishna back into the picture of what you're doing. Take a little time out and okay, why am I doing this? Or for whom am I doing this? I mentioned this, I think, some time ago, but I had a attended a meeting in Hong Kong and had a flight back to the U.S. at USA, a nonstop Hong Kong to JFK flight, and it's so many hours nonstop. And I had a lot of, one of the things that I do when I have long flights is I have projects that I've been putting off so I can have unbroken time and just work on that project. And it's enlivening because I've been wanting to do, and you know, it's saved up, not saved up, but it's postponed because of other circumstances, so I can just do that. So I was one of those, I don't even remember what airlines it was, but a long flight, and towards the end the stewardess came up three times because when traveling through Hong Kong you can't wear devotional clothes. You know, just a problem. So was wearing Western clothes or civilian clothes. So I looked like everybody, and my hair was grown, so it didn't look like a devotee. I just looked like everybody else looked. And I was working the whole time. And towards the end, however many hours later, the stewardess came over and said, "I've never seen this before." She said, "You don't sleep. You know, you're hardly eating. Can we come by with the tray?" And you say, "No, thank you." And you just, you know, I don't know what it is, but you're really devoted to something. And I said, "Well, it's not what, it's who." He said, "Well, whether it's what or who, you know, you're really devoted to something." And then she went and had a conversation with the other stewardess, and she came back and said it again. She came back and said it again. She said, "I've never seen anything like this. I don't know who you are, I don't know what you're devoted to, I don't know who you're devoted to, but you're really devoted to something." So when you're doing something that, you know, that it has that purpose driven, and I can't sleep in airplanes anyways, so I do something. So take the context of your life and what you do, and do it with that higher purpose, and stay focused on the higher purpose, and then you don't become, you get energy. On the other end of a long trip like that, you know, it's, jet lag is definitely, and you know, what, something that I experience. But at least during the flight, I can't sleep. Oh, anything else? Yes,
Maharaj. Even as we are hearing from bona fide sources, after this lecture, when I go home and I contemplate on that message, and I try to apply that in my life, I feel that at some point there is a fine line between contemplation and stipulation. When I'm trying to practically apply, like the answer, the response I hear to Bhujitaya Prabhu about how a pure devotee sees this particular purpose, I know I'm not nowhere near that platform, but I know that this is a message that how I'm supposed to see Krishna's variety. But then at some point I feel that I reach a point where the contemplation becomes a little bit of stipulation.
Okay.
How do I recognize that point and avoid from it?
Well, it comes back a little bit to Charyanishtha's question. You know, take it for granted, and my response to that, take it for granted that part of our conditioning program is speculation, and that's how we apply ourselves because it's part of our conditioning program. So don't beat yourself up because of that. Just recognize that's not going to get me to the point of either proper understanding or proper application. And yet I have this tendency, and it's somewhere between, you know, it's not exactly a fine line between, it's just, it's already there. And so I'm recognizing that it's there. Let me try to appreciate as best I can. The effort from my side is to try to appreciate the essence of the message and to apply the essence of the message. And that's bhakti. And bhakti will purify that tendency. The speculative tendency is this means that. And then that is what I like. So let me do that. Just to conform to, you know, not, there's no change. I just feel good about myself. This means that. So check that tendency and just what's the message and then try to apply the message in a simple way. And continue. Abhyasa yoga yuktena. Chitasa nanigamino. Keep practicing. That. What's the message? What's the essence? Let me apply it. Just keep working like that. Krishna will help you and you'll become purified. Along with the process of chanting the holy name.
Answered. That was the same question.
Oh, he's been very patiently. Yes.
Maharaj, the discussion was reminding me of the sixth mantra of Ishopanishad. One who sees everything in relation to the Lord, he never hates anyone or anything. So understanding everything is Krishna's energy. I had two questions on that point. The purport says that that vision is available for the Uttama Adhikari, but isn't part of the process gaining that realization in a lower level?
Sure. Gradual. But, you know, the full light is the Uttamadhikari. There's the midday sun and there's the morning sun. And there's dawn where you can start to see objects a little bit instead of darkness.
And then the principle in that text says he doesn't hate anything or anyone. So I was wondering, sometimes I experience in a frustrating circumstance sentence or anger may come out towards even something like an object, like let's say the car breaks down when they say, oh, this, you know, is useless, or something like that. So I was thinking that kind of negativity expressed towards an object would be in violation of one understanding that actually everything is energy.
Sure.
So that'd be contrary to a higher view of non-violence.
Yeah, the anger is the frustration that's born from contact with the motive passion. That's what that is. That's what anger is.
Two things. One from yesterday's class, which I
yeah, and you didn't. Your hand went up late.
I was just there was just too much to digest and
okay.
Enjoying the discussion. So Prakash Prabhu's question.
Yeah.
I was thinking that, I mean, this is one of the reasons why, like in the Bhakti Ruksha, we have an application section at the end of the discussion, where, you know, in front of the Vaishnavas, we are doing that. So, I mean, it's nice to contemplate and meditate on the message, go back home, but it's, I feel it's also nice to check that this is the way I'm thinking of applying, is that good? That's one thing. And the second thing, as you were mentioning, I mean, sometimes it's just, we heard this lecture, but my application is just get back to the ABCs and just chant the holy name with sincerity. So sometimes I feel, I mean, our application may not be directly in relation to exactly what we heard, but it may just, you know, reinstate something that I sort of really need to do. ABC is go back to chanting with attention, like up. So just, I guess, I'm just sharing.
It's an really appreciation.
Not really a question. And this is how we can guard against, you know, moving from contemplation to speculation, and then we will lose the essence of the message. So regarding yesterday, I was, thank you for the wonderful exposition on the topic. And as I was hearing you speak and the discussions that it ensued, my understanding was internal cultivation of Krishna consciousness. It felt like it is cultivation of qualities.
Sounds like?
It is cultivation of qualities. For example, I mean, and so as you were speaking, I was hearing you, I mean, the qualities that are required are like, you know, dridhavrata, determination, you know, focus, intensity. Because it didn't seem like it's going to just happen overnight, just like how we have turned away from Krishna over many lifetimes. So, you know, however long it takes, you know, I'm going to stay the course and you know, cultivate this, you know, process. So, I was just, like you mentioned yesterday about this intense eagerness, you know, that's when, that has to be the fuel in the tank to keep going. So, my question is, so is there like one or two or three essential qualities that, you know, that keeps us going on this path, however long it takes?
Well, one thought, when you made a separation between, or it's not a separation, you made a statement that to me this sounds like development of qualities. And what are qualities resting upon? Real qualities are resting upon consciousness. So it can also be said it's the cultivation of consciousness, or Krishna consciousness, because that's the basis for qualities. Because real qualities are enduring, they're not circumstantial. Now you see it, now you don't. Because the circumstances change, now I don't have that quality anymore. But their real qualities are based on Krishna consciousness, spiritual consciousness. So, your question is, are there qualities that are most essential for Krishna consciousness, basically?
Because you said quite a lot of the discussion was about, I guess, things at the workplace, this, that. So in a way, it seemed like the focus was more on, I guess, the behaviors or actions, but I've heard from you, it's the consciousness. So that's where I was going.
So, one answer to your question is found in the first paragraph of Bhagavad Gita chapter 18, verses 8 through 12, which says these items of knowledge are qualities, and the qualities have as their foundation two things. Mai-chana-nyayodena, bhakti-avya-vicharini, exclusive devotion to the Personality of Godhead. And then, yes, it's full shelter in the spiritual master. So those could sound like behaviors, but they're actually qualities, and from those qualities, the other qualities. Another answer could be Shikshastakam 3, humility, tolerance, pridelessness, offering respect to others. And one can be in the spiritual place, spiritual consciousness, and go on in devotional service without interruption. Another answer could be out of the 26 qualities of a devotee, Rupa Goswami says one is primary and the other 25 are secondary or marginal. Krishna Ekasharana is the primary, and that's consciousness. And from that comes other qualities. Yes.
In one of the purports in Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada mentions initially when somebody comes to Krishna consciousness, they have an impersonal conception of God. So does it mean that we have in the initial stages when they come, they have the Brahmavarika conception or the...
Not exactly. Maya? Not exactly. It's not like they have a well-formed Brahman conception. And they're Brahman realized according to that conception. But rather, something more like what this verse is saying, without having heard from a realized Vaishnava, as a new person, if I have a conception, it's the speculative conception of God. And the speculative conception, minus hearing properly, is going to be impersonal, because I don't have the foundation for personal. Even if I say person, God is a person. Here's a practical example of that. When in Christian literature they pass out, you know, little giveaway, call them tracts, and when it comes to the part where they show the picture of God, it's commonly two things: a cloud, and in the cloud is this kind of formless face, and that's God. Then another one is a big cloud, and it looks like Abraham Lincoln sitting in the Lincoln Memorial, you know, a big seat with a, you know, man with a long beard and sitting there looking, you know, really intense. That's God. You know, because he's going to judge you, and you're going to get slapped down if you don't sit straight and, you know, be good and follow Christ. You're going to go to hell, and he's going to slap you. So, is, you know, where does that come from? And then the converse is, you show them a picture of Krishna, and they'll go, no, God can't look like that.
Mm-hmm.
Why God can't look like that? Well, he can't look like that. Although they say God is a person. So here's a person. Like, if he's a person, he has inconceivable potency. Why he can't look like whoever he wants to look like?
The knowledge or the that makes us to the comes us to the right conclusion.
Yes, the absence of that knowledge, one is in darkness, because knowledge is light. But supposing I'm in darkness and I have some faith in God, that faith in God is going to be of the nature of impersonal. Even I may say love of God and God as a person, the concept is still quite impersonal. Like our pranam mantra, nirvishesha shunyavadi paschatyati satari. The Western countries, which are filled with impersonalism and voidism, in the Western countries Christianity is very prominent, and the teaching is God as a person. But behind that teaching God as a person, due to lack of knowledge, there's some impersonal something where God can't have, you know, God can't have form, God can't have name, God can't have inconceivable potencies, although I say he has inconceivable potencies. He can create you know, from Genesis in 7 days, but he can't play in a flute and herd cows. That's not God. Why not? If he's inconceivable potencies and he can create in 7 days, why he can't play in a flute and herd cows? Yes, Gilles.
Alright, so just continuing on her question, do they have like impersonal devotion? I mean, it sounds contradictory.
Yes, it does sound contradictory. They have an imagined sense of God as a person, and that imagined sense is what they're devoted to, because it's not a clear sense of God as a person. So that's unfortunate. So it's not exactly impersonal devotion. It's an imagined sense of God and devoted to that. There's some faith, so it's not, you know, but it's not properly reposed.
And one of the problems that happens is, like you were saying, that God can't play flute, or, you know, they have this conception. They think that God is so powerful that he can't do such simple things. They think that he can only, you know, create cosmos or something like that. Like, there are some Muslims who have this kind of conception that he's only opulent
in the material realm. So, you're just making a comment.
Yes, that's so, like, they don't accept the loving aspect of...
So you're making a comment. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah. Srila Prabhupada. Yeah.